So Thanksgiving is a time where we appreciate what we have. That's the theme of Thanksgiving. Therefore, it's a fitting time for us to take a look at what real Thanksgiving is. Not to say that turkey and fixins, cranberry sauce and family is not an expression of appreciation to this great land that we all live in, but maybe a closer look at appreciation. People ask me if I celebrate Thanksgiving, and I say I do, 365 days a year. Because it's not only a holiday, a time to reflect and to appreciate once a year, but really something that we should be and could be doing potentially on a constant, ongoing basis. I'd like to share a little story with you. It's a couple years ago. I have a sister who lives in New Jersey. I live here in Palo Alto. It's a pretty easy, it's a no-brainer where you want to be, right? Don't really want to be in New Jersey. Usually, if I ask people who've been to New Jersey, I ask them, if they don't live there, have you been there more than once? New Jersey's often a one-time experience. Please come join us. So she was having a party, a family party, and I wasn't able to make it due to my obligations at work and the beautiful weather here in the winter. So I wasn't making it out to New Jersey. But she laid on some of that good old Jewish guilt that only a parent or an older sister can. And like a week before the party, I said, okay, fine, I just got to go. So what did I do? I sat on my computer and got onto JetBlue, or JetJew, some people call it, and I tried to book myself a flight. It was a little more expensive than I would have paid had I gotten a real good bargain, but I got myself a ticket, and before I was about to hit the send button, and the little wheel that starts turning, our systems are jammed, or please try again. So I had to enter all my information again. I was a little bit annoyed. But I did everyone have that experience? You have to buy a ticket, put in your credit card, your name, your little TrueBlue number, and then you have to do it again. So I did it again. Hey, welcome. I did it again, and then only I got my ticket. Please welcome. I get my ticket, and then I read the date to travel, go to the airport. Naturally, the one gate that I have to go to is always the furthest one from security. And my wife always tells me to leave it with enough time. I never do. Like exactly that 45 minutes or hour and a half I need to be at the airport. I go there, I have to run all the way to the other side of the terminal. It's always the farthest one. Never, ever have the closest one. Get there, get through security, get on the plane, get something to read, sit down. They roll away from the gate, got a ride all ready for me. Then the captain gets on the PA and says, due to some sort of mechanical difficulty, we've been delayed. And we sit there for 45 minutes. Then I start getting really annoyed. You know, this is only for their on-time rating. We could have sat at the terminal. I'm sitting here breathing in recycled air. There's a funny smell coming from the... And I'm getting really, really annoyed. So I take out my phone, and I try and call whoever it is that's going to be picking me up at the airport to tell them that I'm going to be delayed, and I can't get through. There are no bars. I'm even more annoyed. And I try and send an email. Doesn't work. I'm really, really, really stressed. The 43 most stressful minutes that I've had in a while. And then as I'm really, really getting annoyed, I look out the window, I think about it, and I say, wow, imagine if this was 150 years ago, and I had to go from Palo Alto to New Jersey. What would I have had to done to make that happen? I would have had like a pony, I would have to get like a telegram, and then it would have been like letters. We don't even know what letters are today anymore, right? We don't hear about the post office unless they're asking for more money or they're raising the price of stamps. What are stamps? An email? That was not even a dream. Getting on a big bus and flying across the country. And I even remember like the first plane tickets I had with that big little... You had to get a travel agent and you had to get one of those stencils. There's just so much that goes into a plane, so much that went into what I had. It struck me that we're living better today than people have ever lived since Adam and Eve had got kicked out of the Garden of Eden. And here I was so annoyed because all these little things weren't going right. And what struck me is that I'm not unhappy or bothered by the fact just that these things are going wrong. Sure, I want things to go right. But there's something really wrong if I'm living in a time where I have so many awesome gifts and I can't appreciate any of them. So the outline, little outline here, take one of these and pass. If we need more, we can have our friend in the front and tell some more of them. We'll talk about the problem today in society. One of the problems that we have is that people in general, there's unhappiness. Why? One of the direct causes for unhappiness is the lack of appreciation. What is the solution to this problem? Lack of appreciation. What's the solution to this problem? Is to appreciate. So I'd like to draw on some lessons in the Torah of appreciation and discuss the challenge why it's so difficult to appreciate, and then find some practical ways to increase appreciation. So first let's outline the problem a little bit. Like we said in their little story, that despite living better than people have ever lived at any time in history, never mind how much debt we have, but the actual living that we have today is better than people have ever lived, we're not very happy. I'll quote a couple texts over here. Compared with Americans in 1957, today we own twice as many cars per person, eat out twice as often, and enjoy endless other commodities that weren't around then. Big screen TVs, microwave ovens, SUVs, and handheld wireless devices, to name a few. Are we really any happier? Let's look at text number one. Compared with their grandparents, today's young adults have grown up with much more affluence, slightly less happiness, and much greater risk of depression and assorted social pathology. Notes Hope College psychologist David G. Myers, PhD. Are becoming much better off over the last four decades has not been accompanied by one iota of increased subjective well-being. People with strong materialistic values appear to have goal orientations that may lead to poorer well-being, adds Knox College psychologist Tim Kasser. Kasser describes his and others' research showing that when people organize their lives around extrinsic goals, such as product acquisition, they report greater unhappiness in relationships, poor moods, and more psychological problems. So when we look around the world, and we sit at our computer and we look at whatever social media we're involved in, we see the tweets and the posts that our friends put up there, it seems like they're really having a great time. All their status updates and the pictures they put up there, they're really having a blast. But sometimes when I've asked groups of students as if their postings really reflect the way they feel on the inside, and more often than not, the answer is no. And our updates are simply a way to make others look like we're really having a lot of fun, when in reality, we are not that happy. So we tell ourselves, do we need more chairs? So we tell ourselves, if I had this or if I had that, if I had something else, then I will be happy, when I'm able to afford to remodel my kitchen, or to get this new car. And I was driving, pulling into my driveway on the way back from synagogue this morning, I saw someone driving a Tesla Roadster. So I figured if I get one of those, then I'll be happy. But in today's consumer-based society, where we're constantly being sold things that we think we need, we believe that when we get this next, we can achieve or can afford this next item, and acquire that, then we'll be happy. Depression and unhappiness today has reached epic proportions. I read two interesting one statistic and one article last week. One of them was the degree of proportion that depression has hit society today. Without going into specifics, it's pretty frightening. The other one is text number two here, which is a quote from Chief Lord Rabbi Jonathan Sacks of London. As Britain's Chief Rabbi Jonathan Sacks criticized, I hope no one takes this personally, as well from the Palo Alto community here, the late co-founder of Apple, Steve Jobs, for creating a selfish society based on consumerism. The consumer society was laid down by the late Steve Jobs coming down the mountain with two tablets, iPad 1 and iPad 2. And the result is that we now have a culture of iPod, iPhone, iTunes, III. Sachs said last week at an interfaith reception attended by the Queen, the Telegraph reported, "When you're an individualist, egocentric culture, and you only care about I, you don't do terribly well," he continued. Sachs told the 70th anniversary meeting of the Council of Christians and Jews that a consumer ethic makes people aware all the time of things you don't have instead of thanking God for things you do. So I thought this was pretty interesting. You can say what you want about Steve Jobs. I'm quite appreciative to him, as I'm a technophobe myself, and he helps me navigate this world of computers and technology. But there's also a significant increase in the I-ness. So we might call this the generation. Every couple of years they change the name of the generation. She might call this, I would dub this the I-generation. And the I-centric world creates a mentality that we're looking for something that I need. A great rabbi of our generation, in text number three, wrote, "Life is full of intense pleasures, which are available to all people, but many fail to appreciate them. The air, water, sunlight, wind, rain, trees, and gardens. The mountains and the seas, the moon and the stars, fire, heat, and cold. The snow and the dew, the use of our limbs, the ability to see and hear, and the smell and taste and feel. The faculty of speech, the faculty of thought and memory, the variety of foods of every taste and color. The marvel of the body's secretions and all of its magnificent chemistry. The universal benefits which all humanity possesses are ignored. It is only when one is about to leave the world that they look back with regret, and it's too late. All that they have possessed, but failed to enjoy. Victor Miller, in one of his books, Sing You Righteous, that daily life is really filled with uncountable details and aspects that we can and should take pleasure in. But most people only realize what we have when we're about to lose it. There's a great story that I heard once of a man who lived pretty well, but he was very unhappy. He had a lot of problems in life. Kind of like our friend on the plane. He had a job, he had a business, but there were so many things that he needed and he didn't have those things they needed, and that led to him to be terribly unhappy. He went to go see a great Hasidic rabbi. And the rabbi advised him, told him, you need to find the shirt of a happy man. If you'll find the shirt of a happy man, then you'll be truly happy. This individual was the kind of person who, when he found something that he wanted, he set his sights on it, he went out and he got it. See, he went on this arduous long journey to find the shirt of this happy man named Rav Zusha. So he traveled for a number of days, and as he got closer from village to village, he asked people to direct him. This is before the days of the GPS, handheld or vehicle GPS. He asked people to direct him towards Rav Zusha. They would smile and they'd point him in a direction. He traveled, and he started to wonder what kind of shirt he must have. It's got to for sure be one of the Brooks Brothers wrinkle-free Egyptian cotton, really doesn't pill or stain resistant. What kind of shirt he must have? And he was starting to fantasize and imagine about getting one shirt just like Rav Zusha had. In fact, he could get them for his buddies at the office, maybe one for his wife, and that'd be great if that one worked. And so he continued on his journey, and finally, as he goes closer and closer, he hears more, everyone smiles here, Rav Zusha. Finally, he goes through a forest, and he reaches a clearing, and he sees a small little hut, and he sees a fellow dancing around a fire, and he's wearing a pair of pants, no shoes, and no shirt. And he wasn't a Stanford student, but he... Sorry. And he says, excuse me, Rav Zusha, says, yes, I am, my good friend, welcome. And he has a big smile on his face, and he welcomes him, he sits him down, he offers him a drink, and he says, what have you come for? He says, I've come for your shirt. I need to have your shirt. Rav Zusha smiles and looks at him, he says, I don't have a shirt. So here's a bit, please.
It almost feels sometimes that our religion and its literature, and it's even from the Gemara, there's a certain value on being poor. You know, there was once a poor rabbi who didn't have anything to eat. There was once a poor rabbi who had so many children who couldn't feed them.
This is a mother goose.
What?
A mother goose. Okay. Being rich, says the Torah, is like an offer. Abraham was very rich and he was very happy. In fact, the Torah points out that Abraham was satisfied in spite of the fact that he was rich.
So why shouldn't we strive?
This doesn't mean if your happiness is contingent on acquiring more or reaching the next level, the Torah promises you will never be happy. We learn about the Torah teaches us lessons about the poor ones because the idea is that whatever situation you are in, it's up to you to define how happy you'll be. If you're happy, we see this in today's society, if your happiness is contingent on the acquisition of material possessions, then it's impossible to be happy. It says in Perkei Avos, in text number 4, who is rich? He who appreciates what he has. Eja hu ashir hasameach b'chelko. Wealth in Judaism, I'd say, is like a lot of zeros. If you have a one in front of it, which would be happiness, it could make you potentially happier. If you already have your life, if someone's life is already directed in the proper way, and they're already living an ideal life, and they have a lot of money, it'll certainly make it better. Make Hanukkah a little more exciting. To get the tickle me Elmo of the day, as opposed to whatever, the wooden block. But if we're not happy and we have that money, it's not going to increase our happiness. That's what I'd say, and well, we can talk more about it after. Let's say as long as we do not appreciate what we have, then we, in fact, in essence, are poorer than the homeless person on the street who's enjoying his coffee. Because we don't have his appreciation of what we have, so in a certain regard, we're lacking more than he is. And studies have shown that appreciation significantly enhances happiness. There's a correlation between those who show gratitude and those who have high levels of subjective well-being. 95% of individuals described feeling happy when expressing gratitude, and 50% that expressed gratitude made them feel, said that the expression, when they expressed gratitude, that made them feel extremely happy. So when people focus on the good that they receive and experience, they're more optimistic about the future, and they report fewer health complaints and exercise more. Now, you may say this is only because they're exercising more than they're happy, but maybe, maybe not. Okay, so now let's leave this for a little bit, introduction. Let's go into a couple texts in the Torah, and we'll try and gain a deeper understanding of how important appreciation is. Who was the first dog owner in the Torah? First pet owner? Anyone?
Okay.
Yeah, oh, I heard that. Cain was the first, Cain was actually the first, the Medrash tells us that Cain was the first dog owner. That could be because you read ahead. No, I'm joking.
No.
Okay, so what happened? Let's look at text number 5. What happened was Cain had given an offering he wasn't happy with, and his brothers Abel had given an offering that God did accept. Cain's offering was not accepted. Cain was jealous and he felt bad, and he attacked his brother and he killed him. And the Lord said to him, "Therefore, whoever slays Cain, vengeance shall be taken on him sevenfold." Rabbi Yehuda said, "The cattle, beasts, and birds assembled to demand justice for Abel." Said the Holy One, blessed be He, "I say to you, whoever slays Cain," Rabbi Nechemiah interpreted, "Cain's judgment shall not be as the judgment of other murderers. Cain slew, but had none from whom to learn the enormity of his crime. But henceforth, all who slay shall be slain." And the Lord set a mark upon Cain. Rabbi Judah said to him, "He caused the orb of the sun to shine on his account." Said Rabbi Nechemiah, "For that wretch, he would cause the orb of the sun to shine. Rather, he caused leprosy to break out on him." There's a discussion amongst the rabbis in the Midrash as to what exactly God did as the sign identifying Cain as this murderer. Rab said he gave him a dog. Let's just stop right there. So what would be the purpose of God giving Cain a dog after committing the first murder? What would be the purpose?
Is that supposed to protect him from being killed?
That's an interesting idea. One idea is it could have protected Cain from being killed. Yeah, I'm a big dog fan as well. But the great Chafetz Chaim gives a different answer, but I do like that one. He says that, what happened? Hevel was more powerful than Cain. Abel was more powerful than Cain. And when Cain was jealous and he was upset, he pounced on his brother and he tried to kill him. And Abel, who was stronger than him, had subdued him and was about to kill Cain. And he said, "Please have mercy on me, let me up." And he said, "You promise not to attack me again?" He said, "Yes." And he let him up, whereupon Cain went behind Abel, and he killed him. So God gave him a dog. What was the message of the dog? Says the Chafetz Chaim that the message of a dog is this. When we have a dog, you said, do you have a dog? Any dog owners here?
All
right. You have to feed them a lot or a little?
A little dog.
Right, okay. A little dog. Now, when you feed your dog a little bit, does it wag its tail and come over and rub up against you?
Yes.
The nature of a dog is even when you feed it a meager amount, it expresses a tremendous amount of appreciation.
All I have to do is walk in the door.
Yeah.
Tremendous amount of appreciation.
So what God wanted Cain to see was that he should have learned from that dog. He should have learned from that dog and shown appreciation to his brother for not killing him and had mercy on him. And what God wanted us to teach him from the lesson of being a dog owner was that he would be able to see and appreciate what he had and learn from his dog. Interesting? So why doesn't God give all of us dogs and then we'd all be appreciators? So I guess God appreciates that not everyone is pet owners. Some people have allergies to dander. So God did one better. He gave us a commandment in the Torah, which is text number 6. And this commandment is also one that is probably as uncommon as pet owners, is honoring our parents. What does it say? Well, I'm going to quote now a text from the Sefer HaChinuch, the Book of Education, which gives both deeper meanings, what do you call it, the tastes, or the reasons for the mitzvot. What is the real core of the reason of appreciating one's parents? Kibud av va'em, showing honor for one's parents. What is the core of that? So the root of this mitzvah, says the Chinuch, lies the thought that it is fitting for a person to acknowledge and treat with loving kindness the person who treated one with goodness. And one should not be a scoundrel, an ingrate, who turns a cold shoulder. For this is an evil quality, utterly vile before God and mankind. It is for a person to realize that their father, and their mother are the cause for their being in this world. Hence, in very truth, it is proper for them to give every honor and every benefit that they can, since they brought him or her into this world. And then two labored many troubling years over them in their early years, in their youth. All the soccer practice, and ballet. When one sets his quality firmly in their character, a person will rise from this to recognize the good of God, blessed is he, who is the primary cause for his existence and the existence of all of his forebears, back to Adam, the first man, and we'll realize that God brought him forth into the light of day. So if you read that, it's a little bit puzzling. Right? He makes a couple jumps there that I think certainly not intuitive. He says, the first part we could all make sense, right? There's an idea called harkara satov, expression of appreciation. And when we do something for someone, they don't express appreciation, we have a negative reaction to that. Like, I give you something, you didn't give me something in return, or you didn't express any appreciation. That's nothing worse than an ingrate. On the other hand, one who you have done something for, and they respond and express that appreciation, it makes you want to give them more, and that's something more beautiful than one who expresses something they've gotten. And therefore, we should have appreciation to our parents because they brought us into this world. That makes sense. It doesn't say anything about the things that our parents did to us, the dysfunctional relationship that our parents had, and all the results that we bear, that we have to deal with on account of that. It doesn't talk about all the things that our parents bless you, that all of our parents haven't done for us. Right? They did a lot of things for us, but there's a lot of things they haven't done for us that we need. Right? I only have the iPhone 4. My mom hasn't bought me the iPhone 4S yet. And they want this. There's so many things that I wanted my parents didn't give me. So you know, that should go into the equation as well. That's question number one. Question number two, sorry, we'll take question after. Question number two is, he seems to make an extension that if I have this appreciation for my parents, it's going to result in me building a relationship with God. How does that work? Is there a simple gratitude that I have towards you, but we're two humans, maybe you're not my mother, but let's just say you're my mother. How does that lead to me connecting to God? I think what the Chinuch is telling us here is a brilliant gem of wisdom. There are two things. One is that we don't appreciate what we have from our parents because we're looking at the things that we don't have. And because we're focused on things we don't have, things that we need, and some of them are very valid needs, there's definitely time to express them, to deal with that. But that doesn't negate the obligation that we have to appreciate the things that they have given us. And if we take those receptors from looking at the things that we don't have and that we need, and we can kind of turn, instead of turning them inward, thinking of all the things that we do need, and putting them outward and think about all the things that we receive from them, i.e. namely just the fact that we live today and the life that we have, and all of the various myriads of things they have given us, then the reaction to that will naturally be a tremendous expression of appreciation for all they've done for us, done so many things for us. And when we start to develop appreciation, we start to think about appreciation, ultimately, says the Chinuch, is the second point, is that it's going to manifest in a relationship with God. How? I don't even believe in God. How is appreciation to my parents? It's not going to force me to believe in God. It's going to give me the opportunity to open up a window where I can't connect to God. How does that happen? So maybe an apt analogy might be looking at a mountain range that's obscured by fog. And you can kind of make out the bottom of one of the peaks on the side. And once you firmly set your sight on that peak, you can somehow figure out a way to draw a line and make it all the way up to the top. And that's when we start appreciating what we have. Ultimately, there's so many things that we do receive, and so many things do come from God, that inevitably we have the opportunity to open up a window where we can build a relationship and develop the sense of profound sense of appreciation, even for God, just simply based on saying thanks to mom and dad for all the good things that they've done for us. It's a tremendous power that Hakara Satov, that appreciation has, can take us from a regular person saying thank you to one who has a relationship with the infinite. So there's an idea in Judaism that the essence of a name reflects the essence of one's-ness, one's individuality. So say Yaakov in this week's Torah reading, what is his name? Why do they call him Yaakov? He's holding on to his brother's heel. Ekev means heel. Adam, what's Adam? Adam is Dam and Aleph. Aleph is one, God the ineffable. Dam is blood. So Adam is spirituality and animalistic urges put together. Shmuel heard the voice of God. Moses, what's his name? Moshe. Min ha-mayim ishisihu, which is interesting, from the water he was drawn. And the name Moses actually also is an expression of appreciation. If you think, what is Moses' name? Is that some Egyptian woman pulled him out of the sea? That's the name. He had many other names that God gave him. The name that stuck was the name of appreciation. So what should be the name of Jewish people? Sort of open that up to the floor. What would be the name of Jews? My first one I think of is complainers, kvetchers, worriers, social activists. It does, bingo. I like that. Exactly. So Kayla, you're also right. Yeah, you're both right. The name Yehudim comes from Yehuda, which is an expression of appreciation. And the trait of appreciation is so central to Judaism is that the name of the Jew is the appreciators. And that's really our job. The essence of who we are isn't the worriers, the daveners, or the mitzvah doers, or the eaters, bagel eaters, but what it really, really is the appreciators. And all these mitzvah doing and all that we do is an expression of that appreciation to God. Now, the essence of what the Jew is, well, how do I appreciate when life's got me down? Things aren't going so well for me. Should I really be appreciating because things are kind of bad right now, and I don't feel appreciative because, sure, I may be alive, and it's great that I can move my fingers and my legs, and I can send emails, and I can go on a plane, but I've got some real serious problems, and I don't feel appreciative. So how can I develop appreciation in that? And is it right to appreciate? Is it the right thing to appreciate when I'm going through a very, very tough time? So you know the song, David Melech Yisrael, Chai V'Kayam? So who is David HaMelech? David HaMelech was one of the great kings of Israel. If you read the book of prophets, and tells about his life, it reads like a drama thriller. Could be, it's actually one of the few parts of the Bible that could be one of a fast-paced movie that would, word for word, be a screenplay today, is the life of David HaMelech. Where did David HaMelech come from? Who was his great-grandmother? His great-grandmother was Ruth. Who was his great-grandfather? It was Boaz. Was the greatest rabbi of the day. And without getting too much into the story of Ruth, it had been that Ruth was this poor widow who had God's divine plan was supposed to connect intimately with Boaz through the process of Yibum, and Boaz was to live with her. And if you think about what a great rabbi's reaction would be when he sees a strange woman laying at the feet of his bed, would be calling some other great rabbis and take her out, or some not as great rabbis and take her out, call security. What is this woman doing on the floor next to my bed? Right? Maybe a restraining order, but certainly he wouldn't connect with her in that way. The Midrash tells us that what happened was God made Boaz's mind a little fuzzy. And it was divinely inspired, and God had wanted this connection to have taken place, and it did. And Boaz and Ruth lived together, and they had Oved and Yishai, and then David. And David HaMelech heard the story when he got old enough, had gone around the table and talking about great-grandpa and grandma Ruth and Boaz. So what did King David do? Every night, he would get up during Chatzos, the darkest hour of the night, he'd grab his lyre or his harp, depending if he was on the road or not, and he would play it, and he would compose the psalms, the beautiful psalms that we sing today, he would compose those at night in appreciation to God for having his grandmother and grandfather get together. Now, but if you look at, we said, if you go through the screenplay of King David's life, it was turbulent, tumultuous. His wife, his first love, died during childbirth, their firstborn son. His own, a different son, tried to kill him, a coup and take away his kingdom. He was at war, he was chased, he was pursued. Tremendous challenges.
He was in hiding.
How is it that King David, one, he's on the road in hiding, playing his lyre, not his harp, because it was too big to lug around. How is it that he was able to compose the beautiful psalms speaking of this close, close relationship to God, with God, when he has his own son is coming to kill him? And I think we see a remarkable thing, a remarkable quality about King David that made him King David, a very defining quality in King David, that he was able to appreciate all of the great things that God had given him, even in light of the challenges that he had. He was able to compartmentalize. He saw the struggles and the challenges that God had given him, and he realized those were opportunities to define him. Now, that just opens up many other questions. We're not going to deal with that right now. That'll have to be another time. Very happy to discuss that as well, about how we process suffering and challenge. But the idea is that even in light of the suffering and challenge, we have many difficulties and challenges. That doesn't negate our obligation to appreciate. And that's one of the special qualities of King David. We see the idea that we can still appreciate even when we have challenges and difficulties. One more text, one more quick idea. Sorry, God, please hold. That's my father-in-law on the other line. Let's say God himself comes to you and says, I've got a task for you. I want you to do something. What do you do? you take your medication, because God shouldn't be speaking to you. But what if you're Moses, and you're in the desert, and you're tending your father-in-law's sheep, and God says, I've got a job for you. I would go and do it right away. Right? I jump on my camel, and put on my GPS, and my little fuzzbuster, and they still have those, and I would head to make a beeline straight for Egypt, and I would take tell Pharaoh to let my people go. What happens? Let's look at text number 7. When God said to Moses, and now go, and I will send you to Pharaoh. Moses replied, Lord of the universe, I cannot, because Jethro received me and opened his house to me, and I am to him like a son. And for one who opens his house to his friend, the latter owes him his life. Hence did Moses say to God, Jethro has received me and showed me every respect. I cannot go without his permission. So if you imagine one of the few screen movies that they have on the story of Exodus, it could be the cartoon version or the Charlton Heston version. But you have James Earl Jones' voice telling Moses, Moses, it is God. Please go, not please, go take your, my children out of Egypt, tell them the time to go. And then Moses, one second, sorry God, I got to go speak to my father-in-law Jethro first. Like, your father-in-law? You're Jewish, you hate your father-in-law. Right? We all have father-in-law issues. So essentially what happens is Moses tells God, hold one second please, I got to go check my father-in-law to make sure it's okay. Make sure it's okay. I'm God. I created the world. I've done everything. Just listen to me. But that's not the correct course of action. The correct course of action, we see that even when God himself is telling you to do something, what did Moses do? Moses said, whoa, one second. Expression of appreciation mandates, dictates that I go to my father and ask him if it's okay with him because he's done something for me. And in fact, we say there's an idea that when one does a kindness for you, Israel Solange, you say, when someone holds a door for you, you owe them your life. Doesn't mean you don't actually owe them your life, but there needs to be an expression of appreciation. And one of the traits that made Moses the ideal ruler, the ideal leader for the Jewish people, was the fact that he had this ability to express and to appreciate the fact that he owed someone for the kindness they had done to him. Adam says, Adam, what did you do? What does Adam say? Adam says, the woman that you gave me from this tree. The woman, Aisha Shenasasi Imadi, the woman that you gave me, she's the one who made me eat from the tree. So I shouldn't be kicked out of the garden. So would that be akin to? Let's say the analogy would be you're at work, and there is, while you're doing so well, your boss hires you an assistant. And one day your assistant brings in some brownies, but it's not just a regular brownie, it's from a party that he had. And it's laced with something terrible. And you go into some people can relate to what I'm saying here, okay? And you get really
fuzzy.
And you do some things that you really shouldn't have done. You raid the snack room, you break into the snack machine, and you get really psychologically discombobulated, and you do some things that you really shouldn't do that are grounds for being terminated. Your boss comes in the next day, or a couple hours later, and you're just coming around, and it's, what happened here? And you explain to him what happened. He said, listen, I didn't know what I was doing. Assistant came, brought me a brownie, had it with my coffee, and then I started seeing flying things and the snack machine. I'm sorry, I wrecked the copy machine and everything else that's ruined here, but it's not my fault. I didn't know what I was eating. It was just a reaction that had taken place inside me. And it was the assistant that you gave me who gave me this brownie, so it's almost your fault. That would seem like a reasonable response to that charge of what did you do? What did you eat from the tree? Right? Would you agree that's a reasonable response?
Well,
I didn't do it.
Analogy.
Huh?
It's a weird analogy.
Weird analogy. Okay. I made it for college students. But I say, if there's something that you gave me, right? You gave me this assistant. You gave me this helper. And this helper tricked me into violating the very rule that you set up.
Confidentiality. Tricked him into giving information to a competitor.
Okay. Yeah, that's better. Okay, fine. All right. It tricked him into doing something that you shouldn't have. Violated some law or rule in the company. So we'd say, I haven't done anything wrong. It's not my fault. It's the assistant that you gave me who ensnared me and tricked me into doing this. So why then was Adam kicked out of the garden? What he said to God essentially was right. It was Eve, it was the woman that God had given him who had steered him in this direction and had gotten into trouble. Just for any woman who might be feeling comfortable, that was the last time that a woman caused any trouble in the Torah. From Eve and onward, probably until today, all the trouble that the Jews have gotten into is all on account of the men. So you can feel pretty good. But, so why was he kicked out? It doesn't really make sense.
He didn't appreciate the fact that he had a wife.
But the wife is the one who got him into trouble. I mean, the wife is the one who got him.
It's a gift from Hashem that he didn't appreciate.
Yeah, so you're both right. The real answer is that it was a lack of appreciation for him to throw back in God's face that he'd given him this wife. Because wife is a beautiful thing. It was a great helper. It was his counterpart. It was his challenge, his productive challenger. It was his sounding board. There were many great things that his wife was doing for him and wanted to continue to do for him. And when he said that to God, it was the woman that you gave me. That's what got him kicked out of the garden. Nothing to do with eating. Had he said, wow, I can't believe that happened. I'm really, really sorry. Make sure it doesn't happen again. God would have just done a mind cleansing and they would have gone back to their earlier state and they never would have been kicked out of the garden. The whole reason they're kicked out of the garden is not because they ate from the tree. It's because it was a lack of appreciation. Okay, so what we're going to do now... So now what we'll do is we'll talk about appreciating things in the present and learn how to appreciate in the present, perhaps. Or at least begin to learn how to begin appreciating. So really quickly, before we get to your point, Ephraim, is why is appreciation so difficult? Appreciation is very, very difficult because, to another person is because we're indebted to them. The idea that when we receive something from another and they help us in a significant way, we owe them. And we're very uncomfortable owing people. Right? Many, 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 many years ago, I was driving back from a wedding. And I was driving late at night with a bunch of people in the car. And sometimes when you're driving and really, really at night, you get really, really tired. I was driving with some friends, and I got really tired. And I woke up to see a huge tree staring right in front of my window, my windshield. And a friend next to me also woke up, and he grabbed the wheel, and he righted it back on the road. And I apologized profusely, and then I was up, and I apologized. The car was just like mumbled, thank you, and I couldn't even look at him. And he had been a very good friend of mine, and I found myself unable to really... Every time I interacted with him, I felt very, very uncomfortable. And I started thinking about it. Why was I so uncomfortable around him? Like, he had done a tremendous thing for me. And it struck me is that I felt so indebted to him. Me and a couple other people could have, God forbid, been either killed or seriously injured if not for the actions he had done. And what dawned upon me is that I was filled with this sense of obligation to repay him. And that made me feel very uncomfortable. But what struck me also, maybe, and I feel even worse now, but it struck me then was that he had done something so big for me that I was not really something that I didn't know how to repay. So what did I do? So I, like a big boy, I called him up, I went over to see him, and I expressed this, wow, and I really, really expressed my appreciation for what he had done for me. And I felt a lot better about the situation. And I realized then that appreciation is something that's very difficult. And when someone does something for us, we find that sometimes it's very difficult to express that. In fact, one of the great rabbis of Israel, by Shlomo Zalman Auerbach, who's known as a great lover of peace, someone was once pursuing him, and I think he maybe poured some water on him during some political upheaval, and he poured some dirty water on him. And he said to the person, what did I do to you? What favor have I done to you that you should hate me so much? So when we owe appreciation to someone, part of the things that when we're obligated to appreciation, that we're indebted to that person, that makes it a little more difficult. And so if we don't want to be numb to the kindness we receive, we have to feel comfortable being indebted. Now, so what are some of the other impediments to real appreciation is routine. When we receive gifts, we expect them to keep on coming. I feel like I'll still receive my wireless, and all the myriads of gifts that we receive, we think will continue coming. And the routine that we have makes us... gives us a sense of just of entitlement, and we therefore don't appreciate. And we don't think of what goes into them. We think about the last time that you had a body part that wasn't working properly. Right? You think about the fact that it isn't necessarily coming to you. So there's once a great rabbi who was ahead of his time, passed away, we quoted earlier, and his grandson comes into the kitchen, and he finds his head in the sink. He had been collapsed in the sink. So his grandson goes over and he pulls him out. He says, hey, are you okay? He thought he had a heart attack. He was very, very strong, late in his 90s. He grabs his hand and he says, get off me. And he puts his head back in the sink. He submerges his head in the sink. His grandson's looking at him. He's like, something's really wrong with Zadie over here. When he finally comes out and he comes out of the water and he takes a big breath, he says, what are you doing, Grandpa? He says, I was just taking a walk with someone and he was complaining about the pollution in New York and how dirty the air is. And I wasn't feeling positive about air. So I put my head under water to really, really, really appreciate air. That was Rabbi Victor Miller, and he was this profound sense of appreciation. In his 90s, I know people who'd find him in his 90s picking up peach pits off the ground and marveling at the nature of a peach pit, and he's filled with a profound sense of all of the gifts that we receive. So do we ever think about air? Unless we're underwater, we never think about air. So how do we tap into the goodness that we receive on a regular basis? So there are three ways that we can become more appreciative, and this may help us with our time. One is taking note of detail. Number two is contrast. And number three is realizing that it's not coming to us.
Who says this?
I say this. Think about the detail and take note as to what we are experiencing today. Think about that turkey. And think about all the details that went into bringing this turkey to us. Or soy turkey, I don't know. Whatever it is that we're appreciating today. Think about all the details that went into it. Think about the farm that it was raised on. Think about the corn that the turkey ate that it was that some farmer had grown. Think about the free range that we all eat, only free range birds. Think about the extra amount of land that someone had to buy for that turkey to walk around with extra space to have that free range bird. Think about the food. Think about the truck that a person had to drive the turkey. Think about the humane slaughterhouse that made this. Think about the rabbi who koshered the turkey. Think about all the things all the details that have gone into our turkey. And we simply eat something, we think that we're just eating it. But if we think about every single step that went into the process of that turkey, we have a far different experience. King Solomon makes two contradictory statements. He says, "Matza isha matza tova." He who finds a woman has found something good. And he also says, "Motzi isha marmi mavas." I found the woman to be exceedingly bitter and more bitter than death. How can both those ideas be true? Says the Gra, well, when we appreciate our wife, when a husband appreciates his wife, he sees all the great things she does for him, then he's struck with this profound sense of, this is the best thing in the world. But in every relationship, there are positive things and there are negative things. When we negate and we stop focusing on the positive things that we get from our significant other, then we find all we find is the negative things. Right? We have whatever negativity there is, or part of a bargain that I'm probably not holding up that I should be. I focus on that, and I'm struck with the sense of negativity. I'm like, well, what do I need this for? All I have is this. Please, I don't know. Put this that way. That this a bunch of things, obligations that I'm not doing, and I'm filled with a sense of bitterness. But the idea is that if we can focus, if one is only focused on what they don't have and not what they have in that relationship, and they don't think about the good things that their significant other is doing for them, then they're going to find that their lot is more bitter than death. It's the same exact woman. She hasn't changed at all. But if he appreciates, says the Gra, if he appreciates all the great things they're doing for him, then he's filled with a profound sense that, wow, I have a really, really great thing here. So number one is detail. Number two is contrast. What does contrast mean? Contrast is, think about the dinner that you have when you're at home. Or think about something you have on a regular basis that you gain from, something great that you receive. And think about when you're in a situation where you don't have that. Think about that coffee shop that you have, they make your coffee perfectly exactly the way you like it. And think about it being in a conference somewhere, you have to drink police station coffee. And then it hurts you to drink it. And instead of just drinking it and complaining, oh, I have to drink this coffee, or this is not my usual dry cleaner, or my secretary's out and I have this temp in who's really administrative assistant, sorry. Think about the things that instead of feeling negative about things I don't have, focus on the things that I usually do have. And think about that and felt on that and dwell on that and realize the great gift that I have on a regular basis. Think about when your shoes in the shoemaker. Think about how much you like that pair of shoes, how comfortable it is. Because we all have so many things. If we think about the contrast when we don't have the use of that item or that thing, then we'll feel much better about it when we actually do have it. Think about when I just sustained a couple months ago a shoulder injury. And now instead of feeling upset that I can't really move my shoulder well, think about when I do have my shoulder. Think about my other shoulder. Think about when you hurt a finger. Think about all the other 9 fingers that you have. And in that way, if you look at the contrast, we can appreciate all of these gifts that we do have. Last third idea is realizing how lucky you are. Nothing's coming to you. I was coming back from Israel this summer. I had the opportunity to go to Israel with students and come back with my family. We were sitting online for probably 3 hours getting through immigration. And I heard some people in front of me really, really complaining. It's 3 a.m, our plane was delayed. We've got to wait here while these people take their time and sit and they should have more people working, more officers working here. We should go through here much more in the world. There are people who would literally give their arm to be an American citizen. All the gifts that we have here. You can occupy, certain places you can occupy and it's pretty safe. You can protest, you can blog, you can say pretty much whatever you want so far, and no one will do anything to you here. Try that in Qatar. Try that in some other country and see what happens. So how often do we ever think of the fact that we are Americans and we're so lucky that we're Americans? So 99%, 1%, forget about all that. Just think about the gifts and the rights and the opportunities that we have as Americans. The taxes that we pay. But think about the what they call the Medina Shel Chesed, the country that's built on kindness that we have here in America. There's an idea that the way Rabbi Israel Salanter says this is that when we see a small child pick up a ball, we have this, wow, it's so exciting. When Junior takes his first step. But in reality, every step that we take, we should have appreciation the same way that small child has when they take that first step. That's really what we should have. What happens when we get a new car? We're really excited. We're going to get a new car. And then in a short amount of time, it's already done. But we have the opportunity to think of all of these three things and think about even the pleasures of mine. Think about all the benefits that this car affords us and gives us, even if it's not a Prius. There's so many things that this car actually does give us and so many benefits, such contrast to the things that we have. Do you think you'd be happier if you kept an appreciation journal? And most of them responded that they did. And I said, well, if you didn't, then why aren't you? And I didn't. And then something big happened to me, which I was tremendously appreciative for. And then I started it. And I opened it up and I just started writing down things that I'm thankful for. And some of them were intuitive. There were obvious things that that are big things that I have. And then I started getting to smaller things. And I started applying the rules of contrast, detail, and how lucky I am that things are not coming to me. And there's so many things that I started appreciating. And almost to the point that it's almost odd. I see door hinges and door locks and it's so many different things that, and there's so many and tears and hot water. I went to the Palo Alto, the mikveh there to tovel some to immerse some new vessels in the mikveh, and it was freezing cold at 6:30 in the morning, and I realized how water is, and I wrote for a page and a half on warm water. And it wasn't that long. I mean, it was a long time ago. People would take how many hot showers? You think your great grandmother had in her life? How many hot showers did she ever have? You could take an endless. I mean, the price of water today. I don't know if you can, but you could take an endless amount. You could take hot showers as often as you like. And then we have the sun that warms up that water at some point. And there's so many gifts that we have. Never think about it. In fact, there's just so many gifts. And you can get into anything from a coffee cup lid to a cell phone case to a cell phone to eyelids, but there's just so many things that we have to be appreciative. And if there's anything you have that's really, really good, and we start to have it on a regular basis, it gets very, very old. And I'm a big coffee aficionado. I just got my hands on some coffee that's $50 a pound. I didn't pay for it, certainly not at retail, but I didn't pay for it. But I had this $50 a pound coffee, and the first time I had it, I was like, this is a spiritual experience. This is an awesome cup of coffee. If I was willing to part with it, I would have given it to a friend of mine just to show him how good it was, but I couldn't part with it. And I've been drinking it for a week and a half now, and it's like, no, it's just a cup of coffee. So I need to be able to get into it and realize and revel in that, the notes and qualities, and become a connoisseur and express and be cognizant of all the goodness that I have. Last quick idea. There used to be a slogan of the New York Lottery, all you need is a dollar and a dream. And the idea was that if you have a dollar, then you can dream and potentially you can become phenomenally wealthy through winning the New York Lottery. But I'd say it a little bit differently. What struck me this morning is that you don't need a dollar. I mean, it's good if you have a dollar. I'm not saying there's anything wrong with having a dollar. But you don't need to have a dream. We all already won the lottery. It's almost as if you were walking around with not one, but 10 winning lottery tickets for $100 million Powerball lotteries. And we all have that always. How can you be upset if you just won the $10 million lottery? Every one of us. If we look at, my son was somewhere, he came to me and said, Papa, I saw a man without an arm. He was real distraught. So I was talking to him about it. And then I said to him, hey, buddy, imagine if you had a third arm you can strap on, how many things you could do, how unfocused we'd be, multitasking, doing three things at once. But imagine if you had that ability. You'd be like, wow, that'd be so cool. But we have two of those. And how often do we think about the fact that we have those? But by through writing down, making these lists and reconfiguring lists and keep on writing, and you think you'd run out of things, but you don't. And you keep on writing and working in there, and then there's some days we can write a three paragraphs on one idea and just keep on writing these lists of things. So many things that, I could go on for hours here, so many gifts that we have. And the idea that we really are all lottery winners. So as we bite into that turkey today, take note of the details, the contrast, realize nothing's really coming to us.